Welcome to The Librarian is In, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. I'm Frank.
And I'm Gwen.
And later we will be joined by Rena Glazer, who she works at a nonprofit in D.C. called the Pro Bono Institute. And she's a podcast host, and she creates these great reading lists for people who want to learn more about pro bono work. And they do like a summer reading thing. And also, she is my cousin.
Nepotism. Is she just, are her books all about law and legality?
No. Well, so the you know what? Let's let her tell us.
Yeah. All right.
The summer reading books are not. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'll find out more later.
Yes, you will. So.
I have more sex books.
Great.
But then I will move on to other issues of the humanity.
Okay.
It's just happens to be. But it's actually a fun, well written, but it's a biography. It's called Mary Astor's Purple Diary, The Great American Sex Scandal of 1936.
So now you're into like historical stuff.
By Edward Sorrell. And it is really, it's cataloged in the library as a biography of Mary Astor. And it's by a very famous political cartoonist, Edward Sorrell, who did cartoons for very left-wing liberal magazines in the 60s, came to fame in that period of time. And this book is illustrated with his sort of jangly, caricaturistic drawings. And what's interesting, he also interweaves in the story of Mary Astor and this great American sex scandal his own life as a cartoonist and a bit of his personal life, but how he also came to discover this great American sex scandal. In the 60s, he was living in like a railroad flat in New York, and he was digging up the linoleum, and underneath the linoleum were all these newspapers, sort of like as a base to put the previous tenants to put the linoleum on. And as he was digging up the linoleum, he noticed the headlines of these newspapers, which dated from 1936, and they were all about this actress named Mary Astor and this scandal that she was embroiled in. And he stopped digging into the linoleum and started reading these newspapers, and he became so entranced by the story that he wanted to find out more about her and find out more about what happened. And so he goes on this journey of discovering who this actress was and what happened to her in the mid-30s.
So wait, do you mean Mary Astor, like Astor, the way that everything in New York is named Astor, such as Astor Place and also Astor Hall in the library?
Astor? No, okay. Actually, funny you should say that because it's very Hollywood. Mary Astor's real name was like Lucille Langhank. And in typical Hollywood fashion in the 30s and now, certainly then they renamed actresses and actors to package them. And she was named Mary Astor because she had a very patrician, regal bearing, and they were riffing on the Astor name for sure. Okay. So it's funny you should say that.
Astor Hall is in the 42nd Street Library.
And the Astor family was a big giver of money to the library.
Yes.
So he continues to, he looks into her life and then became obsessed with her and a real fan of her. She was an actress who started out in the silence, and she had a very, he talks about her childhood, as most of us, or it seems like in books, have difficult childhoods, very overbearing parents, very strict, very dominating, and her father decided when Mary Astor was a little girl that she was going to be the meal ticket. I mean, imagine like, the 20s and the teens. She was born in 1906. You know, I think this is before Social Security. I mean, it was a different kind of world where people who didn't have means looked at whatever assets they possibly had and then put them to work. And a lot of times it fell to the kids in some ways. So she was sort of like they cast about what she could do because she was a pretty girl, like music, acting, whatever. And she eventually got into silent movies and started with John Barrymore, who was a famous actor. And she has a little thing going on with him that's delineated in the book. And so she was working from a kid's age and very much under the thumb of her parents. She didn't actually leave her parents' home until she was like 20. And then she sort of escaped in some ways because she was completely dictated to about how she should behave and stuff like that. So as you can imagine, like steam released from a pressure valve that's been tightly closed. You know, once she got out of the house, it was like wild times in the 30s, and she was making a lot of money in Hollywood. She was never...
Was she a flapper?
She was more like her image.
Did she flap?
In the 20s, her image was more of like a virginal ingenue. Okay. And then she sort of segued to these sort of patrician, aristocratic women. And she said something interesting that he quotes in the book, Edward Sorel, that she never really, she was offered the potential to be a star, like a top flight star, but she refused it because she was afraid. She felt a star has to carry everything. They have to carry a film, and if it fails, then they're out. And she wanted to stay on this sort of middle road of featured actress, supporting character part, so she could, you know, have longevity, which is, says a lot about her personality. I mean, for someone to refuse like stardom is pretty, must be pretty tough, especially mm-hmm. in this day of celebrity mm-hmm. mania.
If you're coming from a background where you had nothing
right.
and you,
well, maybe, yeah. but maybe the opposite, she had nothing and she wanted mm-hmm. to retain what she did have. So she's an interesting person, and he goes into her life in detail, but then it comes to this actual scandal that did happen. Like I said, she was out from under her parents' thumb. She did eventually get married and had a child in the early 30s. And then, of course, the marriage was breaking apart. And during the divorce proceedings and the custody trial to gain custody of the daughter, her husband, or soon-to-be ex-husband, found her diary and used it against her in the trial to gain custody of the daughter for himself. Now, this is where it gets interesting. It's like... what's interesting to me is a lot about media, is that as Edward Sorel was researching her life and this scandal, he discovered that the papers made up diary entries. Oh. Like when the judge would say, you can't release this to the media or the newspapers, they would sort of make things up.
Oh.
And so her diary became like a lot more lurid than it possibly was, even though we don't know because the diary's been burned now.
It's a great age of yellow journalism.
But you know what it reminded me of? And I find it so interesting. I'm going to deviate. I think you got a good sense of the story, yeah? Deviate a bit is that a couple of years, months, whenever ago, you're walking by a newsstand and you see like the cover of two magazines, like Us or, you know, pop culture, mm-hmm. Celebrity magazines. Mm-hmm. And I remember one day there were two magazines side by side, different magazines. Celebrity magazines. One said, let's say, Jennifer Aniston pregnant. And then the other one said, Jennifer Aniston divorce shocker. And I was like, I remember I thought, well, what? Because I'm like naively thinking there's some truth everywhere and you want to reproduce the truth. And I thought, it's blatantly two different stories. Yeah. Like, so what's true?
What's true is that they want to sell magazines.
But then I
thought,
like,
true.
Any consumer, wouldn't they say and look at that and say, this whole thing is bunk? Then I thought, you know, these magazines are not telling the truth, obviously. Mm-hmm. They're literally using real people, celebrities, as soap opera characters for the consumption of the consumer to indulge in these passionate, glamorous lives like they've always done. Like mm-hmm. the Great American Sex Scandal of 1936 was that, too. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if the consumer, the person reading this, in some level knows it's all bunk. Because they can't look at those two covers side by side and think, I'm getting the truth about Jennifer, you know?
Yeah.
Or is it a willful suspension of disbelief to go into this fantasy world? It's so interesting, but yet it's technically journalism. I mean, I know it's pop culture, celebrity stuff, but, and I'm not even going to get into other things about not true news and things like that. I'm talking about celebrity
yeah.
right now. I think we should just keep it at that. Anyway, I just thought it was fascinating about... Mm. People's lives are involved in these, and they could also be culpable in them. Like celebrities feed media their stories, and it's all such a crazy game. But I remember when I walked by it, I was just like, how can anyone legitimately purchase into this?
Yeah. It's a nice reminder that that isn't new, right? That like this book is like, it was going on in the 1930s.
It's not. And you know, people are not staid. And this, parenthetically, the biggest romance she had that was in her diary. It was with a playwright named George Kaufman, who wrote many, many famous Broadway plays. They go a bit into his life because he had a wife and they had an open marriage. And this is the 30s. Mm. But like, you know, those things existed throughout time. Mm-hmm. I mean, about sex and love and relationships. And it's just what the culture of society said. You just worked with that. Mm-hmm. Like I said the last time, like we tend to think we're so liberal and got sex and we know it now and there's no reason to feel shame, but yet we all have some degree of it. And, you know, it just doesn't change. It's just whatever the parameters we're working with in the society. So anyway.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a good read.
It is.
Are you done with it? Did you finish the whole thing?
I did.
Yeah.
And it seems to be very popular. Mm-hmm. So it's Mary Astor's Purple Diary, which was the media said she wrote in purple ink, which she didn't. So that's why it's called that. Mary Astor's Purple Diary, the Great American Sex Scandal. I know, they made it purple, so it's like purple prose.
Right, they
manipulated it.
It was on purpose. Wow.
The Great American Sex Scandal of 1936 by Edward Sorrell.
That sounds great.
So I have one more.
Oh, look at you.
Which is a gear shifter. A writer I've never read before, never heard of. If she's listening, I don't want her to be insulted, which I don't think she will, because I'll tell you in a second how her writing indicates she wouldn't really care that much. She might care for a minute, and then she would say, fine. She's an Australian writer named Helen Garner. And the book I read, which is her latest, is a collection of her essays and nonfiction writing called Everywhere I Look. It's a beautifully made book, I should say. It has wide pages.
Yeah,
it's a paperback. It's got this great, clearly staged picture, almost evocative of some famous photographer, I can't remember, of just the Helen Garner, the author, center stage, surrounded by people in various stages of walking or being walking down the street or being in a public space. So you sort of get the idea she's sort of this figure who observes human nature around her. And, you know, I know it would be to me, because I love fiction, but, you know, saying, oh, it's essays and it's nonfiction writing, you're like, But her voice is such that, and she has written fiction, and she's written long-form nonfiction journalism on some very controversial topics like sexual harassment. She took on a sexual harassment case that was a very controversial book called The First Stone. And, you know, I'm trying to think of the word. It's not sympathize, but she takes the harasser's side at times in terms of explaining his point of view, and then the girls too. So that sounds incendiary, but her writing is such, she has an ingredient that I love, and I've talked about in this podcast before, where she will make an observation. She's very crisp. She could seem like prim and proper, but she's not. Her writing is what you would call reasonable or straightforward or those kind of words, but like really, what do they mean? And she makes an observation about her life or about the world around her, and you get it, and then you think, okay, that's what she thinks. And then as she moves on, you realize by the end of the paragraph, she's almost reversed her opinion. Or she's colored it with a very different perspective. And you get there without knowing it. Like, her writing is so good that you just are with her, and you're like, oh, she's complex. Mm-hmm. There's complexity there. It's not just, well, this was this, you know, and that's that. And then she goes on. And her writing is, I was trying to think about how to describe her writing, and I was going to say it's without metaphor. It's so direct that there is no simile or metaphor. There's no, you know, the sun was like a burning diamond, which just could be beautiful. I don't mean to make fun of it. You just get the sun. Like, if you get a metaphor, sometimes you think of a diamond all of a sudden. You're thinking of, oh, a diamond in the sky, and you sort of riff off on that. When she describes the sun, and she doesn't say the sun, she'll say something about the sun, you're just seeing the sun, at least I was. Mm-hmm. But yet she must have metaphor in there. It's just so straightforward, direct, and appropriate to what she's trying to do that you see what she's trying to tell you.
That's great.
It's sort of like, excuse me, it's like she talks a lot about, which is what I was saying before, I love, about where she's involved as a human being in the situation she's writing. Like, she doesn't pretend to say, like I said about that sexual harassment case, like, oh, you did this, you did that. She says, where are my emotions in
this?
But she doesn't say that to us, the writer. She doesn't say, where are my emotions? Mm-hmm. She just does it. Mm-hmm. She'll start saying, like, she makes observations all in the book, these wonderful observations, and almost invariably they are changed by the end of the essay, or changed in some way. It's not always a radical about face.
That's like a very adult way of going about writing. Like,
thank you.
That, because it's like not sort of taking a position and then proving it, but like actually discussing your opinion and working through it on the page, and then like egoless, right?
Very good way to put it. And as she would say, it takes a lot of work to get there.
Yeah.
The back page talks about how she writes, and she, you know, it's a labor, but she endeavors to be reasonable. Mm-hmm. And you used a word before, thoughtful. Like, she endeavors to be thoughtful and see where she's involved in this, but also try. But yet, it's not a sentimental writer, but yet there's great sentiment for nature. There's great sentiment for family, but it's not sentimental and it's not cold. It's not, like I said, she could, and she says it, could be a prim, mousy, older woman, but she's a human being and she can call herself that too.
Yeah.
Before, I hope I got that across. I just want to read the very first line, really, of the book to give you an idea of what I was sucked into when I started reading her. All right. She, really the first paragraph, she goes, this is Helen Garner from Everywhere I Look, the first line of the first essay. When I was in my 40s, I went on holiday to Vanuatu with a kind and very musical man to whom I would not much longer be married, though I didn't know it yet. He was at ease in the Pacific climate, but I hated the tropics with a passion, all that sweating and melting and shapelessness and blurring. And what I hated most was the sight of a certain parasitic creeper that flourished aggressively, bowing the treetops down and binding them to each other in a dense, undifferentiated mat of choking foliage. I longed to be transported at once to Scotland, where the air was sharp and the nights brisk, and where the plants were encouraged to grow separately and upright with individual dignity.
That's amazing.
I was like, when I was reading it, I was she's being very like, you know, a British, she's Australian, but like a British slash Australian figure we're used to. The prim, upright lady, like I just said, she's not, saying, oh, I was with man, very kind. I wasn't going to be married in very long, but I didn't know it yet. And then she just deep dives into this parasite on a tree that's weighing it down that she can't stand. Yeah. And suddenly you get see, that's a metaphor.
And it is a metaphor.
But it's an emotional,
super visual
directness about, something's going on underneath the surface.
Yeah.
She's married and she's on a trip, like we all have. But she doesn't know she's going to be divorced from him soon. But yet you suddenly get this emotional underpinning of what she's going through, like hate with a passion. Don't, these parasites, it's disgusting. Mm-hmm. It does this. I want to be here. And you get all her emotional sense without her having to say, it was like, or I felt. There was none of that. It's just suddenly you're in it. And I was like, that's a contrast. Oh, that's, and I felt like I was reading about a real human being. So
yeah.
Helen Garner, Everywhere I Look, I recommend it. And she's written fiction and long form nonfiction
as well.
That's
so cool. That reminds me of, did you ever read those Rivka Galchen? I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name properly, but it's called Little Labors. It's this like little book. And I think it actually was very popular. We've had a bunch of people ask for recommendations based on it. And I'm going to use that as a recommendation.
Oh, goody.
Because that it's the same. And I mean, not the same, obviously. Everyone has a very different voice, but it's something similar about like kind of paring things back to like very clear, visual, like direct comparisons to things.
Yeah.
There's something similar there.
Directness is difficult.
It is difficult.
I mean, when you think about it, you know, in life and in putting it on the page, it's very difficult.
Right. And you have to be willing to like, you can't distance yourself from it, right? That like, if you're writing like that, that's like you and you can't get away from it.
Perfect, Gwen. That's the perfect thing to say to fill this in, because I said at times I was trying to think of where I was emotionally with her, and I was sometimes was afraid of her and therefore disliked her, because I was like, you're making me contemplate whether I'm as honest about my own self. And it's tough. But then I was like, you know what? Go with this. And it's very satisfying.
Good.
And she's a great...
It's a good recommendation.
Great writer. So
awesome.
Thank you.
Cool. Well, I don't have any grown-up books. I'm glad you did too, because I only have a children's book today. I've been reading some stuff that I wasn't super crazy about, and then I was reading a young adult novel that I loved, but it's not out until July, and it's not in our catalog yet, so I'm not going to talk about it. Teaser, come back in July, and you'll hear more about it. But so I brought a children's book that is on heavy rotation in my house. I had to actually like sneak it into my bag last night so that my son did not see me taking it away. It's called Maybelle the Cable Car. And it's by Virginia Lee Burton, who we have talked about on this podcast before, and who is a pretty famous old school children's book author, writing in the 40s, 50s, and 60s mostly. And she wrote Mike Mulligan and the Steam Shovel. She wrote Katie and the Big Snow, which I've talked about here before. And she wrote The Little House, which was like this book that was sort of about progress and how terrible it is that humans are ruining the earth. And that's, yeah. So this is a fascinating story. And she tends to do this thing both with Mike Mulligan and with Katie and the Big Snow, where she personifies a large piece of machinery or equipment, which is like right up the alley of toddlers, right? And so this cable car, who's named Maybelle, is in San Francisco, and progress has come, and the city fathers are saying, oh, we don't need cable cars anymore. And it has this like nice little interesting, like, lyrical rhyme that it doesn't always stick to. So, like, here, I'll read a little bit of it. The way it's written, I find really lovely, because we also are in a very heavy Dr. Seuss phase in our house right now. And I love Dr. Seuss and I love reading it out loud, but the rhymes are like rhyme, rhyme, rhyme. It's the sort of like insistent thing. And this is like just very loosely sort of, let's see. Maybelle had a bell on top, ring two to go and one to stop. Underneath, she had a grip to grab the cable under the street. She had three different kinds of brakes, one for the wheels and one for the track, and an emergency brake to jam in the slot so she could stop whenever she ought. Like, it's very, it's sort of not, it's not in your face, the rhyming, but it's really fun to read.
It gives you a comforting rhythm, though.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And the thing that I like best about this is that it, in the guise of being a story about a personified cable car, it is actually a story about democracy, because it winds up, so these city fathers have said, oh, you're out of date, cable cars, and we don't want you anymore. And it's all, this is all based on a true story. And she dedicates it to like the fighters for the cable cars in the city of San Francisco, where she grew up. She spent part of her childhood there. So they've decided Maybelle is too old fashioned, and there's this kind of mean bus who's like bullying her and saying like, oh, I'm faster than you and you don't, whatever. And he's, you know, on the side of these powerful city fathers who want to get rid of all the cable cars. But then toward the end of the book, it starts to say like, okay, the people have decided that they love their cable cars. Some of the people, not all of the people. And so it actually like takes you through every step of this like citizens' campaigns to save the cable cars. And so there are these grassroots organizers. They start a petition. They present the petition. They get a ballot initiative approved. Then there's a vote. Then there's like the tallying of the vote. It's a really simple, easy way to explain how like grassroots activism works. And in the sort of framework of a government. And it's like hiding in this book about a cable car. And it's really cool. And of course, like Maybelle is victorious and the cable cars are saved and they're still in San Francisco. And then she's very gracious to the mean bus at the end. But it's just a really great story with a really cool lesson that's like really a powerful little book in its own way.
That would be an interesting conversation to have with a kid after reading it, to see how much they got about that process. Because I could imagine a very thoughtful, again, that word, kid saying, well, why can't they have both buses and cable cars? And you're like, because money, kid. Right. And because people want to please constituents they think want just one or the other. And why does it have to be one or the other?
And it doesn't. Like, they actually do. The bus doesn't go away. But there's also this part where it talks about sort of the strength of the underdog, too, because the whole reason that cable cars went into San Francisco in the first place was because the hills were too steep for horses and stuff to be able to get up them properly. And so the bus can't get up and down properly either. And so the bus is, right, exactly, this like mean bullied bus is like sliding around on the street. And at the end, he sort of is like, it's good that you're still here. And she's like, yeah, it is good. And then she gets a new coat of paint. And
is
like,
the bus personified it?
Yeah.
What's the bus? Does the bus have a name?
Yes.
What's the name?
Oh, hold on.
Is it a male?
Yeah. What do you think? Oh. Let's see. His name is Big Bill.
Oh, dear.
So let's see.
Maybelle.
And he's jealous. And but Bill. See, it's also, it's quite sensitive to Big he's Bill human. Because it's saying why. Let's see. One day as Maybelle was going along, taking her time and singing her song, Big Bill honked his horn and hooted, out of my way, you little old cable car. I just heard the city fathers say that cable cars must go, that you're too old and out of date, much too slow and can't be safe. And worst of all, you don't make money. What they want is speed and progress and economy, and that means us. Ho, ho, poor little old cable car, too bad you're not a bus. And he ground his gears and shoved his way into traffic, leaving a trail of gasoline fumes and Maybelle sad and unhappy.
Actually, I love that. The writing in that book.
Right, the
and
writing
I love
is
the
amazing.
Idea of like humanely, you know, hopefully humanely bringing in money to kids. Like, it's so important.
Right, it is. And, so and to like important. Explain why this thing was going to go away and then wasn't going
and
to go
not
away.
Lose the humanity.
Yeah. It was written, and it's old, you know, it's old fashioned and it's using these really beautiful pieces of art from the San Francisco Public Library archives. Originally published in 1952 and then reissued in 1997.
Oh,
so
nice.
Virginia Lee Burton, Maybelle the Cable Car. It's a great picture book.
So it is. It's a big thing in your house right now.
Big, big in my house. Really? I mean, Katie and the Big Snow is still, I think, the most popular. But I think I think Maybelle has surpassed the other three.
What is it about personifying objects? I guess do kids think it's funny? They giggle at it? Or do they think it's just like, yeah.
I think it's just normal for them.
There's emotions in everything.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I want your son to come on the show. I think we should interview him about his favorite books.
Maybe we should. Like, he has so many opinions. Oh my gosh. We're still reading the dinosaur encyclopedias, but it's like, calm down a little bit.
Oh.
I was just talking to someone about this. For a while, he really was not into library books. Like, he would go to the library and I would always be like, look at all the books. And he just wanted to play with the puzzles and do all of this cool stuff that they have for him at our local library, which is wonderful, in Westchester. But, of course, I'm like, look at all these books we're going to take out. And he really wasn't interested until I sort of manipulated him into being interested by taking books out myself, picking ones I thought he would like, and then emphasizing how special they were, that like, these are library books and it means that everyone has to share them. And these books belong to everybody all together. And they have to stay in a special bin next to our sofa, and they cannot go upstairs, and they can't go in the car, and they can't sort of like be treated as your normal books. These are special books. And that hooked him. I think he gets it now. So he really loves like every new crop of library books that we get. He gets like one or two.
He's obsessed with the best mother in the world.
Thank you. Great.
You just did that. I win. That so perfectly.
Yeah, by manipulating my child to like the things I like. Does that make me a perfect mother?
I think I have
the
blog post headline. We don't, the best mother in the world.
Yes. My work here.
We haven't even
done.
Talked to our guest, who's coming up now, I suppose.
I think she is. I think it is almost time to go get her.
Perfection.
All right. Oh, we'll be right back.
Yay.
And we're back. Hi, everybody. We are back with Rena Glazer from the Pro Bono Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I am a longtime listener, and I'm a little starstruck to be here where the magic happens.
Oh, dear.
How can you be starstruck? You're like my cooler cousin. The whole time I was growing up, I was always like, oh, my cool cousin Rena. And you went to college in New York, and I came to visit you, and we went to an a cappella concert. Do you remember that?
Crystal clear.
So amazing. It was the first time I'd ever seen a cappella.
What's the group?
It was like a college group, I think. Yeah.
I think, Barnard, Columbia, acapella was big. Even back in the day. So
were you the first to go to New York in your family?
No, my father actually went to Columbia as well.
So, oh.
Yeah.
Nice.
My branch of the family kept it local in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And my mom is a Patterson girl, so.
New Jersey?
Yeah, hardcore, so. Yeah.
I haven't read that poem. What William poem? Carlos Williams Patterson.
I don't know the
it's
poem.
It's a famous poem about Patterson, New Jersey.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know the poem too?
There, I recommended poetry. I've wanted to bring up poetry for a while.
Oh, nice.
Next podcast.
Let's put that poem on our blog post.
Okay.
All right.
Oh.
There we go. And we're done. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Poetry. Okay. So we're going to talk about the intersection between lawyers, pro bono work, books, and libraries today. I'm really excited. Do you want to start?
I can't address this. I'm sorry.
Okay. Bye. We'll see you later. So yes, why don't you tell us a little bit about the work you do very briefly and the role that libraries and lawyers have together?
Great. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here. So I work at a small nonprofit in Washington, D.C. called the Pro Bono Institute. And our mandate is to promote access to justice through pro bono work. So we work with large law firms, in-house legal departments, and public interest and legal services organizations to help provide legal services to the underrepresented, those in need, and for causes that are in the public interest.
That's amazing.
You must be very busy right now.
Yeah. Lawyers are having a major moment right now, I think, like especially do-gooder lawyers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say engagement is quite high, and that's exciting. Mm-hmm. And there's always a tension, I think, to balance the trend, what's in the news, what you think of as sexy, with the bread and butter issues that people need help with day in, day out. So kind of leveraging the interest and tapping into it in a sustained way is going to be important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, before we get to the booky book part of everything, tell us about the thing that you mentioned earlier, which was the Lawyers in the Library program.
Great. So some people may be familiar when you think of pro bono and libraries is a real movement that's happened in New York, in Washington, where I'm from, around the country, just loosely called Lawyers in the Library. And it's part of this idea, which you've talked a lot about in this show, about the purpose that libraries serve as community centers, serving a variety of purposes, providing education, knowledge, information is power, helping people with questions. Mm-hmm. And in our field, there's been a great push towards, it's got a nice term, place-based pro bono, which is going where the clients are, meeting them where they almost physically are. Because as you can imagine, it could be intimidating to figure out how to schlep downtown and go to a big office when that's not necessarily your community. So going where the people are. Mm-hmm. And libraries then have been great hosts and partners for these projects, lawyers in the library. And they really provide a continuum of programming. So some programming of lawyers in the library would be know your rights type sessions, right? Where at 7 o'clock on a Monday, come hear about housing, come hear about family law, come hear about immigration, and people will give a talk and it will be really a general legal information session. Other programs involve appointments. Make an appointment on Wednesday from 5 to 7 and you individually can meet with a lawyer about family law, housing, you know, whatever the topic of the issue is. Another interesting Lawyers in the Library program also involves distance and people who live in communities, rural communities, where they have a library, but there really aren't a lot of lawyers. And we now can use technology like Skype or computers, and people can be in their local library, but there aren't people in that community who can help them, but the library can help with the technology, so I can sit in my office 100 miles away and help them remotely. So the library has been a big partner in
That's amazing.
Too.
Is there something characteristic about somebody that you might see as in need of a lawyer or in need of legal help? Like, is there something characteristic about that person and their view of law and legality and lawyers?
I think that's a great question. And again, there's a real spectrum, so it's hard to generalize.
There
but
should
I think
be.
This is also where books come in handy.
Okay.
Because I think when your tool is the law, you think every problem is a legal problem, right? Yeah. Like, you know, sort of surgeons. And so we're always looking at, oh, there's a legal issue. People don't always think that way. They think, I have a housing problem. I have a sick kid with asthma. I need a divorce. I need help. I don't know what kind of a problem is, and often the problems are very interrelated, but lawyers are good problem solvers. So I think one thing, and books help us, is reminding ourselves to be sensitive about people coming from different places and different backgrounds with different expectations, and really having open conversations to the best we can, and being very clear about what do you need. Am I the best person to help you? Maybe it's a social worker. Maybe it's a different type of professional. Maybe we can work together. How do we get you the help you need, whether it's a pro bono lawyer or something else?
Well, librarians, how do we get the help? How do you get someone the help they need? And that, I mean, just quickly, I feel like being a librarian, as I've been in the business so long, I feel like being a part of your community for a really appreciable amount of time is so helpful as you, if you're in the right community for you, that the people and you sort of interact, have the same interests or same feelings. I mean, of course, like you said, there's a spectrum. Human beings are human beings. But if you sort of get it and become a trusted member, I mean, what a conduit that could be for to you, let's say. You know, they're just like, you know, I'm getting evicted. And they don't see it as lawyers or legality as being part of their life. Like, they don't have a right to it even.
And it's super intimidating.
Exactly. Like we all, don't... like, we talked about money, growing up with money. It still intimidates me because my parents were like, we don't talk about money. And paying bills now is a bit of a hassle because I'm, like, emotionally invested. Same thing with lawyers and things
well,
like that.
Yeah, well, and a big problem that we have in this country is law is so complicated.
Yeah.
You know, even smart, competent. It's so technical. It's so difficult that to navigate a system without help, you have a huge inequality right there.
Right.
So a lot of this also is process, right? If people, regardless of the outcome, feel like the process has been fair, someone was on their side, or they got the information that they needed, they feel better about the whole justice system, right? They feel like I didn't get a raw deal.
Emotions.
Yeah, even if the outcome was, it was fair, right? Yeah. The process was fair.
Yeah.
And that makes a big difference.
Yeah.
So books.
Yeah, so tell us about
some... Where do books come into this?
Yeah.
You said they did.
Well, so what yeah. are you what are some us. Of the books that you were referring to earlier?
Okay, so let's kind of step back. And
Let's
right?
step back.
How did I even Ooh. Start thinking about
You're
books?
You're not in a courtroom here.
And pro bono.
This is
no,
like,
I was a litigator,
you just
right?
Told, so you just told us what to do, what and I obey. I
want to do
obey.
It.
There we go.
Well, I wanted to give you some context about how on earth did I start thinking about books, and it wasn't just because I have this awesome cousin, right, who's a librarian. We started, like everybody, in around 2010, a blog. So whatever you think about a blog, good, bad, I have sort of mixed feelings about a blog. I do like that it forced a certain discipline of having to generate content regularly. And that, I think, especially for our younger staff, is great that they got into the habit of mm-hmm. working on their writing and deadline. And but you also have to be an idea generator because you need to produce regular content.
I believe you
content,
mean content creator.
Right? Content creator. I'm sure there's snazzy millennial words for that, but they wouldn't be mine. So I enjoyed sort of working on that. And what I found was, in addition to just being a billboard, sort of promoting our own stuff and, you know, kind of looking for media content, we really got a lot of resonance with our pop culture posts, right? Where you would see people on TV doing pro bono, like The Lawyers and The Good Wife did
oh,
tons
yeah.
of pro bono, and we would blog that every time, right?
I loved that
right,
show.
Right, yeah. Anyway, so the intersection with pop culture, John Oliver does tons of Access to Justice mm-hmm. and platforms, and we get a lot of pop for that. And so it was, we were heading into Memorial Day weekend. And so every magazine, every, I'm sure, library was doing summer reading tips. Mm-hmm. I was like, let's do that. You know, mm-hmm. we could do pro bono and Access to Justice related reading recommendations. So that's how it started. Mm-hmm. And didn't really have any rules. So we could talk a little bit about sort of nonfiction memoirs, just some of the books that we've recommended and how they fit in. The only sort of guideline that I've tried to stick to, because it was a total default, to me it was like the obvious books to promote. So as long as we have other things, we're going to resist this. Like the back pocket insurance were John Grisham books. But I will say, I love them. They're very popular. And John Grisham himself is a huge supporter of legal aid. So
really?
In Charlottesville, in the Virginia area.
And I mean,
area,
he was a practicing lawyer,
yeah,
right?
And he's very generous.
Yeah.
And so thank you, John Grisham.
Good job, John Grisham.
Yeah.
And I feel like he brought so much prominence to that genre, too. Like, I mean, certainly legal thrillers were
yeah.
around before him, yeah. but, like, there's nobody who even holds a candle to him.
Yeah, and yeah. really many of his books spotlight legal service lawyers when people really don't understand sort of the people toiling in the trenches that make enormous financial sacrifices, you mm-hmm. know, for themselves to work very
yeah.
hard and really do amazing work.
He also
work.
Did a lot of stuff with, like, citizens getting involved in the law, like the Pelican Brief, which, yeah, where she's on her own as a concerned citizen being like, I'm going to learn about the law and I'm going to figure out how to, yeah. I think John Grisham, you're doing good work.
But you didn't want to, per se, recommend him.
Oh, yes.
Too
oh,
easy.
Right. So
even
yeah,
though you approve
him.
And support.
He was like,
I didn't mean that. I meant you had other. You were going somewhere else.
Recommended in the
yeah,
ether.
Yeah. No negativity to him. I mean, so, but you seem to be going to another
no,
section.
No, we just wanted to highlight things that were maybe under the radar screen
right.
that people didn't necessarily
everyone knows
know
John
about.
Grisham.
Yeah. So yes. maybe I'll throw a couple out there for
yes,
you.
Yes, please
Let's
do.
Talk books.
All okay. right.
Great.
So
dig in.
One I have, and I'm curious if you've heard of them, know them, or have read them. So this is a new-ish one. Came out this year. Mm-hmm. It's called Stand Tall: Fighting for My Life, Inside and Outside the Ring by Dewey Bazilla. Have you heard of him?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No.
Wow, stumped the librarians.
Oh, please.
And we're not even playing the game where I read to you.
I know.
Which just seems...
Oh, it's so much fun.
Okay. So Dewey Bazilla, this is his memoir written with...
is that his real name,
that
Dewey
Bazilla?
That is his
Bazilla? Name, Bozella.
Huh.
It's a New York story. He's local,
uh-huh.
Dutchess County. He was an amateur boxer. He had a very hard and sad childhood. Amateur boxer. When he was a young man, he was wrongfully convicted of murder.
Oh
he was
God.
Incarcerated, including in Sing Sing,
oh
for
God.
25 plus years.
Oh.
He spent that time boxing because he was a boxer, right? Sort of boxing in jail. Also taking classes in theology, trades, all kinds of things. And very regularly writing the Innocence Project to say, this is an injustice. I am innocent. Help me. Help me. Help me.
Maybe say what the Innocence Project is, just in case anyone.
Sure. So, okay. Pop culture. People, OJ is having a renaissance with the miniseries, the documentary. So people may remember Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld from the OJ Experience. Yeah. Anyway, they're amazing lawyers, and they created a nonprofit called the Innocence Project when DNA really became accepted and there was amazing forensic science that could really exonerate people. Mm-hmm. So it's not just he said, she said, right? Mm-hmm. Questionable eyewitness testimony, but verified science that could help the wrongfully incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And now it's become a network nationwide of nonprofits working with pro bono lawyers to review cases and represent those they believe the evidence shows have been wrongfully incarcerated. And so Dewey got the Innocence Project to take his case, finally, and they engaged an amazing law firm, Wilmer, Cutler, Pickering, Hale, and Dorr, known as Wilmer Hale. I work with them all the time. They're amazing. And they worked tirelessly to show that he had been wrongfully convicted. It is a happy ending, happy as these things go. He was released mm-hmm. from prison.
Did he write this book himself?
With the professional author.
Okay, cool.
He later sued Dutchess County for violating his civil rights and won. They have a multi-million-dollar settlement. Mm. He is a speaker and an activist. And the reason I thought you may have heard of him is once he was released, the sports community embraced him. And they actually arranged for him to have one professional fight so he could say he was a professional boxer. And in 2011... he won an ESPY. Do you know what the ESPYs are? ESPN yeah. sort of awards.
I actually know what that is.
I don't know what
that's
that is.
That's the one thing I know.
That's ESPN, some sports ball word.
Right, the channel.
Yeah, okay.
The channels. Yeah, right. The family of channels. They, in the summer, I think it's after the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, there's kind of like a few days when there's like no sports. It's like, I'm sure for some people,
oh
woo!
My God,
and
how
for
terrible.
Other people, they don't know what to do with themselves. So they have these award ceremony like in LA with Hollywood stars, pop culture, and athletes and all kinds of things. And they give out the Arthur Ashe Courage Award. Mm. And in 2011, Dewey Bazella won the Arthur Ashe Courage Award. You can look up his video, his testimony. And I am especially inspired by Dewey because a couple years ago, he came and spoke at an event that my organization had. Mm. And talk about inspiring and riveting, because he is not bitter. He chooses wow. not to be angry, and he chooses to forgive and turn the page and see goodness. And I feel like it is a very empowering and powerful story. Mm. And lawyers can make a difference. We can bring justice.
Yeah, talk about pro bono work making a difference in someone's life. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think of the fight. Like, you know, in that particular instance, like, there's so much you said, like, you know, about DNA and all that, and the evolution of that. And, you know, we know enough from books and the culture that even if the DNA is respected and it's true and it says this, it can be manipulated because of politics, because of economics, because the public wants blood. They want someone guilty. They want someone caught. They want someone punished. It's like that kind of narrative, like needs to be gotten rid of. It's like it's not as important as the human life. You know what I mean? It's
I
like,
do.
But yet you know this, that media thing. It's like, ah, that murder's solved. He's gone. You're safe on the streets. And it's not true.
Yeah, our stats look good. Actually, that's a great segue. This is someone who works for systemic reform. Right. It's amazing to help individuals. Yes, we need to do that. But we need to fix the system.
Yeah.
Right. We think, you know, OK, that's great. Mm-hmm. We have to be in the trenches. But we also big picture people,
yeah.
you know, forest trees, sort mm-hmm. of all of that. So do you know Brian Stevenson? OK, great. So he is amazing. His memoir is Just Mercy. a story of justice and redemption. And I understand that it's been optioned for a movie. So if you're the people who like to read the book before it becomes a blockbuster, now's the time.
Yes.
And I believe the actor who's associated with the project and who's going to play Brian is Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, yes. Because of Friday Night Lights.
Friday Night Lights. And The Wire and Creed and Fruitvale Station. Anyway,
He's a charismatic guy. Yeah.
So in the artist.
Did you say he's hot?
By charismatic.
And then in the artistic. You mean?
I thought I'd say, see, I already am fudging words. I should have said the same thing.
In the artistic sense.
Yes. Oh, yes. He's hot in the artistic sense. Yeah. And in the popularity sense.
Totally. So if you like to read before you view, now's a good time. Mm-hmm. And Bryan Stevenson is, talk about charismatic and amazing. This is the story of how he became, you know, his life and how he dedicated his life to the public interest and as a legal services lawyer. He founded an organization in Montgomery, Alabama called the Equal Justice Initiative. And they are really pioneers in, again, getting people who've been wrongfully incarcerated, exonerated, dealing with racial disparities in our criminal justice system. And he has been a pioneer in a very compelling issue, which are rights of juveniles. Mm-hmm. We, the United States, has had a problem of juveniles who commit crime, locking them up for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
And science caught up to say, kids' brains aren't, I mean, look at what you were like when you were 13, 14, right? I mean, all of us.
Yeah.
So, and the science caught up and the Supreme Court figured it out and has issued rulings that say you can't automatically do that. You know, you have to. Mm-hmm. And so now there's a huge pro bono effort underway. It's called Juvenile Lifers, of people who committed crimes when they were young. They're now 50, 60, 65, 70 years old. And they are entitled in many instances now to resentencing because of these rulings. So pro bono lawyers are jumping in, reviewing their cases, helping them navigate the parole systems in states that aren't so easy and friendly. And he is a compelling figure. So if you'd like to watch, look at his TED Talks. If you watched, are you familiar with the documentary that came out the 13th? It's the Ava DuVernay.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
I read a New Yorker review.
Yeah. Well, I recommend. It's a hard watch, but it's very powerful, very good. He's interviewed in it along with a lot of other people. So
I mean, yeah, you bring up, I was going to ask you a question, but I realize it's a whole other podcast and probably an endless conversation when you said systems. And like, how do you, as you were talking so persuasively about Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy.
That's his book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you systematize that? Like, systematize the view of juveniles. When you were talking, I don't know, maybe we can cut it out. But I remember when I was very young, like 8 or even younger, I had a best friend and we got into a fight and I was so angry that I grabbed a lunchbox and bashed him over the head. And I ran out the door.
Oh my
and
God.
I hid because I somehow knew I did something terrible. And my parents and their parents eventually, it was like a search party, went out and found me. And I was like mortified. He had to go to the hospital and get stitches. You know, if it went the wrong way.
In different circumstances, that would have ruined your life.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's what I'm saying.
That's what I was just thinking
too. And
how do you,
then I suddenly saw, I know how I feel. I know I was clueless, but how culpable. Mm-hmm. And how does a system around me say, throw that kid away or it don't. I mean, you know, it could have changed everything. That one moment of passionate anger. But then also you could say, this kid's got an anger problem. He's going to grow up to be a problem to society. I mean, I shouldn't have brought it up, but it's
and
a huge subject. And I am.
Just a different kind of problem.
I'm wreaking
to society.
Havoc as we speak.
Well, it is a subject that's having a moment. The idea of rehabilitation.
Yeah.
The idea of over-criminalization of our population. And are we better off both as a society, culturally, our values, and economically, which is why it's a very bipartisan, you know, sort of issue of building communities, strengthening the resources so people get the chances that you had.
Absolutely.
And that's where you see pro bono and legal services very intertwined with, because it's all of this is complicated.
Yeah.
Right? Housing, education, and if it did jobs, go differently, the law, communities.
It's true. And I was thrown, I would look at myself as a criminal person. In some ways, I would say you're a damaged, unworthy person because you did this. Anyway, sorry, producer, I went off on me. But that was fascinating. Really fascinating. Really fascinating. And that makes makes me want to read that particular memoir.
I really recommend. Nice, empowering, and very engaging. And his life story is impressive. And he's often in New York because I think he's affiliated with NYU Law School.
Oh. And to see how someone comes to that kind of work.
Yes.
To see how they are drawn to it and how honest they are about it.
It's rough. I mean, the circumstances he worked in as a young law student, you know, to say this is my dream. A different type of book that I think fits in with the same sort of pro bono landscape. Mm-hmm. And I thought about this in particular because you've talked about behavioral psychology and what influences motivators. And we do too, because as you can imagine, if part of your job is to be a cheerleader, a nudge, you know, a rabble rouser, mainly trying to convince lawyers to do pro bono, right? That you're getting out of your comfort zone. This is not what you practice. We're asking you to go do something different, to learn, to challenge yourself. How do you do that? How do you convince people to do things? How do you get lawyers to volunteer? And we work with this amazing consultant. He is both a lawyer and a PhD in psychology. Mm. And he recommended this book. And it's been around. It's very well known. It's called Influence. Do you know it? Robert Cialdini.
I don't think I do.
I don't.
Wow.
Three for three.
So when I went to get this book from my library, it's been around for so long, there was no wait. Like, it was the best hold ever, because it's been out for a long time, and it was in paperback, and it was great.
Here in the library world, we call that backlist.
Yeah. And his new book, I think, is called something called Persuasion. It's like, you know, you can tell.
Funny.
It's cool. I have not read that one yet, but Persuasion. Anyway, Influence, New York Times bestseller, really big. I think people in the business world like it because they're negotiating how to get what you want. How do you get influence with people? But it doesn't just have to be for commercial purposes. How do you get people to read? It's for anything that we are championing. We all advocate for something.
That's cool. So this is sort of like pop psychology.
Yeah, and science. You know, it's very well researched and compelling. It's an easy read. And I wanted to share one of his constructs,
which really
speaks to me. It's called social proof. So for all you experts out there, maybe fast forward for the next 15 seconds while I mangle the definition of this and bring it down to the layperson's perspective. But I think of social proof as peer pressure and the bandwagon effect. Mm. And this is how we have – it's why laugh tracks work. You hear laughing, you're predisposed to laugh, right? It's sort of marketing that way. And I have told people – you want to change the culture of your law firm and get people to do more pro bono, you need role models. The leaders of the firm have to do pro bono and be seen doing it. Other people will do it. Make it cool. We all want to be cool. You know, even the least conforming, the biggest nonconformist, you know, of us, we want to fit in. We really do. And there's science behind that. And the best example I'll talk about, which is kind of weird on a podcast to talk about a video, maybe we'll put it on your show page or something. Totally. It is the best example of this. And once you watch it, you'll immediately get the concept and you will laugh your head off. Do you remember Candid Camera?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want to explain Candid Camera for your younger listeners?
I never actually saw Candid Camera, but I know the concept. So the concept is that there's a hidden...
I grew up with this.
Did you? Anyway. Frank, you
then,
tell us.
Right, you tell us.
No, the concept is it was a TV show where the host, Alan Funt, would go into situations and have a hidden camera and put people through their paces. Usually there was an actor involved to sort of trick people and see how human nature responds to this. And how basically it's YouTube, I guess.
Is it? Yeah. Do you like think you're alone and then?
No, not always. Oh, like sometimes.
It's a man on the street type of. Do you watch Billy on the Street at all?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It kind of makes me think of that. Although those people totally know.
Like he'll have a mailbox on the street that starts moving, and he just films people's reactions to something that shouldn't be happening. He does a lot of kids stuff, like he asks kids questions
and kind of innocent
questions, see what they
say.
Very innocent and very and usually the people who were tricked are on the show and they're just all laughing. So it was a good feel.
So this is. And you may have seen it. It's people in an elevator. Okay. And the cast are people in an elevator. And the unsuspecting public, like the mark, is just getting into an elevator.
Okay.
And the people in the elevator, the cast, do crazy things. Like turn around and stand the wrong way. Oh. Who does that? Nobody, but the mark does.
Right.
Because they want to fit in.
Oh, that's funny.
Okay.
That's really funny.
Wait, is this a show?
It's little skit from Candid Camera. It's from 1962. From Candid Camera. Oh, you can find it on YouTube. But you see it and you're like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you want to fit in. You feel uncomfortable. You want to fit in. Everyone's taken, it's the 60s. People wear hats, right? Think Mad Men. That's what they dressed like. So hat on, hat, and you watch the people doing crazy. What the heck are you doing? You just want to fit in with these six strangers. You don't want to be the misfit,
even when you don't get it.
Even when you don't know why, right. And it is ridiculous, they all do it. And it is laugh out loud funny. Wow. And once you watch it, you're like, it's a powerful pull to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's leverage that. Let's leverage that to get people to read. Let's leverage that technique for the good, for the social good.
Mm-hmm.
So that peer, that's is awesome. That bandwagon effect or peer thing?
It's called, the scientists call it social proof.
Oh, that's what
But
you
to
said.
Me, it's like the bandwagon
social
effect.
Proof.
Social proof.
I get you.
Awesome. Yeah. And if you read Influence, you can read Influence. The other criteria.
Influenced by? Awesome.
Robert Cialdini.
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 Okay.
That is amazing, and I want to hear 6 million more book recommendations. However, I think we are approaching the end of our time.
Uh-oh.
So do you have one or two more that you want to throw out really quickly?
Why don't I throw out my rec?
Okay.
Am I supposed to bring a book rec?
Yes.
Okay. So this book I feel passionately about, and if you've already recommended it, then be like, sorry. And it's on point. I had so many others, but let's stay on point because I love this book. It's Evicted.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Poverty and Profit in the American City. Yeah. Have you read it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we have it in the library.
Lots of copies because it took me, like, I don't know, a long time to get off the hold list for it. Matthew Desmond, MacArthur Genius Grant winner, sociologist at Harvard. It is beautifully written.
Yeah.
You know, just from the read, in the sometimes nonfiction is more beautiful to read than the novel. Mm. It's just gorgeous writing. So just from that. It is heartbreaking.
Yep.
Heartbreaking.
About the housing crisis.
Yeah, he embeds in Milwaukee in low-income neighborhoods and really tells their stories. And it spoke to me because, as we talked about before, a lot of what I think about, if we're going to deliver effective and meaningful, respectful pro bono services, is to really understand the community, the clients. And this is such an education. So even if you're not, you know, lawyers, social workers working in this field, I think this is such a great read if you want to understand humanity. If you want to understand people, both people and the landlords and just the whole perspective, I think it was incredibly eye-opening. And when we talked about why do we read, why do we do this, to think about empathy, to think about lives beyond our own, to feel something, I am just in the tank for this book.
Yeah.
I really think no matter who you are, it's a great read.
That book, I think, does something that really, really good nonfiction often does, which is to take something that's in the news that you're hearing a lot about, like foreclosures, and suddenly make it really personal. And I think both good fiction and good nonfiction do that, where it, like, it pulls it sort of into you in a way that just reading a news story never could.
I put it on display all the time. I mean, and that's true. I mean, because what's at the core of, like, any issue that we discuss is personal feelings, personal stories. And it's not just telling a story. It's telling a story with the mind to illuminate a situation and a problem.
And what did you think? I didn't think he had an axe to grind. Like, I felt like he was, and it was hard because he was living with these people. So he had to divorce his personal, I mean, he obviously developed very personal feelings, and there are footnotes where he talked about this, but I thought he was very fair in trying to really tell these people's stories, good, bad, ugly, without sort of the value judgment. It's not patronizing.
Right.
I think that's why it really resonates. It just sings as life.
I mean, if you find that human connection that he clearly found between people, then you understand that all the negatives of all our personalities are not as important as what the through line is. If you make that connection, and that's what you said, and I had said before about being a librarian in a community, it's like you really have to be there. You have to put the time in to understand the community you serve. It seems such an obvious thing now, where you can't just bounce around from job to job. I mean, you can, but come to believe in so many of these professions we're talking about, it's like that commitment to a community and the right one that you can help, something in you that can respond to it. whatever community is, there's many, many, many communities.
Yeah, and I think it's an empowering message because we all can help. Yeah. You know, get in the game. You can really contribute.
Right,
you
in
can
various contribute. Ways. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good one. That's a very good
that
one.
That is good.
Evicted.
Good. Yeah.
Matthew Desmond.
Yes.
Yeah.
What are yours?
Awesome.
Did you already do yours?
We did ours. Yeah.
We'll have to listen to the podcast.
I'll get mine off the radio. Thank you. One time listener.
We can
first
do our
time caller.
Non-book recommendations. Yeah. First time guest.
Oh, now you do your non-book.
Now
we're
having a non-book recommendation. Oh, no, no. Oh, you want me to go first?
I
never go first.
You go. Have
them. Okay. So I do have one. I just started listening to a new podcast called Loud in the Library. It's two teacher librarians in Grand Rapids, Michigan named Chris Patrick and Tracy Krenka. And it's great. They interview authors. It's really fun. They're very informal. And I really like it. The Loud in the Library podcast.
What about my podcast? Disappointing.
Have we talked enough about your podcast? Maybe we have.
We haven't talked about it at all, Gwen.
Oh my God, we didn't talk about it at all.
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh no. Okay, I'm sorry.
Mention it. We have to mention it.
My real endorsement is
the pro bono happy hour.
Oh, pro bono happy hour.
You can
sorry.
Find it on iTunes.
It's funny.
Just
I was just thinking
for pro
that,
bono happy hour.
And then I was thinking about pop
it's
culture
the number
happy hour,
one
but no,
rated, yeah. Pro bono podcast.
Is it really? Congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
How many are there?
In this room, it certainly is. Okay, yes. Pro bono happy hour is an amazing podcast. Rena is the host of the podcast. And I can tell you that I don't think of myself as like the target audience for a podcast about law or about pro bono work or anything like that. However, it is so good and so listenable, and your guests are so interesting, and you do such a good job sort of like focusing on what they're really truly talking about and not sort of getting lost in this like morass of legal jargon and whatever. It's so good. I really love it and look forward to it every week.
Oh, thank
so
you.
Yes.
Kick back.
Is
to
it
you.
Fun listening to her knowing
it's so
as
fun.
You know her as a child?
Yes.
Like that comparison thing.
It's so fun. Well, even just hearing your voice every week. I'm aww. Like,
do you think it sounds like me? Because you know how you don't think your voice sounds like you?
Mm. Yes,
do you
I
listen?
Do think it
can
sounds
you
like you.
Yeah.
At this point, I
you're just
fine.
Can't even
you're
deal with it, but I just let it go.
That's cool.
I do think it sounds like you. Yeah.
That's what I sound
I mean,
like.
I'm sorry. It totally doesn't sound like you. No, it absolutely does.
Cool.
I have
and
no
I find it's really inspiring, actually.
Well, thank so you for that shameless self-promotion.
Yes, anytime.
Thank you.
I can't believe we neglected to mention that you are a podcast host as well.
Okay, what's your non-book rec?
I don't have one
really?
Anymore. I can't think.
Slacker.
My non-book rec. I had one. I,
food? Nothing?
I really have, this past like couple of weeks,
travel,
I've been reading
vacay,
a ton
anything?
Of things. Yeah. I mean, I could recommend lots of things, but.
You haven't been watching a ton of things?
No.
Or listening to a ton of things?
Well, I should say, then you know what I should, I don't know if I've recommended this, but well, that's actually funny. I thought, was thinking about that when you were thinking what the non-book rec should be. I do watch for comfort, even though I loathed and despised them as a child and at the time, is 70s game shows. So there's a channel called Buzzer. I may have talked about this. It's a New York
so.
Local thing that just shows nothing but old game
the
shows.
The old originals?
Right.
Also, what
like
you
What's
like?
My Line?
Yeah.
Tattletales.
Newlywed Game?
Oh, press you Your Luck.
Press Your Luck? How do you remember that, Gwen?
I'm on today, Frank.
But that's I gotta say, it's energy. Not 70s. The 70s ones are referring to the childhood ones, but the one I think is actually a entertaining show is What's My Line?
Yeah.
They're so
classic.
Charming, and in the truest sense of the word. And it's when public figures, pop culture public figures could be smart and articulate and erudite and use big words. I mean, it was not this talking down thing. It was very aspirational, yes. I think, for the audience members.
Good. You don't feel like you have to take a shower after you watch it.
It's not like, no, it's not like, you know, the Jerry Springer years.
Yeah.
But so I watched that for comfort, even though at the time I couldn't watch game shows as a kid and stuff. I mean, when they were silly, sure. But now they're just so comforting. I don't know why.
It's nice.
It's a comfort thing. So that's my, cool. That'll be my
that's
rec.
Good. That's a good one.
There's a lot of What's My Lines are on YouTube.
It's nice.
Cool.
So this was hard. I had so many. So I wanted to narrow it down to something that just makes me happy. Mm-hmm. It was like one of the best thing I've watched in the past few years. I just love it. It's available at the library to take out on a DVD, also streaming
nice.
Everywhere.
Cool.
So did you see the documentary Iris?
Mm-mm.
Iris
oh, yes.
Apfel.
Oh, yes,
Iris
I have
Apfel.
Seen it.
You know Iris
yes,
Apfel.
Yes, thank God. The fashion darling.
Icon.
With
her
husband.
Yeah.
She's cool. like 90
cool.
now.
Right, with the huge round glasses.
Okay.
She's like 4 feet tall.
Yeah.
She's amazing. So there's a documentary about her called Iris. Mm. And it's a love story. It's a love story between her and her husband. It's a love story between her and fashion. I wanted to do it because it's a love story of New York.
Yeah.
And it's so New York. It's like crazy. And she's one of a kind.
Yeah.
And I like that. I think for anyone, back to the peer pressure, if you feel, what do they say now? You be you. She's the original UBU. I mean, she just operates to the beat of her own drummer. Mm. And there's this great line where she says, you know, I'm not pretty. I have style. And that's fine because pretty fades. But style is smart and pizzazz and what you make of it and never ending. And it's just so charming.
It's awesome. So good. It's like the very best of what New York is also about.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of talk about comfort. Like I said, that personality, Iris's person, and that documentary is like just pure comfort to me. Like hearing her point of view, the strength, this matter of factness, the New York humor. I love it. Oh, my God. It's
highly, highly recommend.
Totally.
If you need escapism for a little while.
Awesome. And also seeing a personality who's like navigating not the easiest city in the world in a very aspirational way.
And I think in some way, maybe she reminded us of Grandma.
Aww.
Right?
Whose Hello.
Life, yeah. Whose life arc just saw so much. And I think in challenging times, let's learn from those people. Mm-hmm. Right? They've persevered, they're resilient, and it's great messages. Plus, it's just funny and delightful.
Oh, great.
Iris, I recommend.
All right. That's a great one.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming the whole way here from DC in the pouring rain. It was so great to have you. I feel like this is a lifelong dream fulfilled.
Yeah. Thank you. Me too.
All right. So everybody, if you could go review us in iTunes, that would make us super happy. You can check out the show page and go to nypl.org/podcast to see a full rundown of our episodes. Also, someone just pointed out that for a very long time, the email address has been incorrect on that page. I really apologize. I did not realize that, but it is fixed now and you can email us at nyplrecommends@nypl.org. And thanks so much for listening. We'll see you in 2 weeks.